Registration for Ottawa's Midwest Morel Mushroom Fest is now open, happening May 3rd, in memory of the great Tom Naumann. It's a non-competitive, family-friendly way to identify and pick morel mushrooms on a guided hunt. Purchase your tickets now at visitottawail.com.
Today is Wednesday. It's April 9th, 2025. It is 2:42 in the afternoon, and that's critical because we're going to see what the markets are when we get to 3 o'clock, or pardon me, 3:30 this afternoon as we tape this podcast. It's been a crazy day. I'm John Williams. This is the podcast for people who care about Chicago and the world. You can find me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago History Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher and author of the Picayune Sentinel, a newsletter on Substack that cares about Chicago and the world.
So in our pre-podcast Google Doc chatter that we do on Wednesdays, we were all happy to admit that none of us are economists. So let that be the caveat to this discussion. Still, economists and economic commentators of all persuasion have been uniform in their derision and incredulity at what has been happening with the markets. So it seems fair to operate from there as at least a starting point. We aren't the only ones that don't entirely get it. Today, the president announced a 90-day pause on new tariffs. There will still be a baseline 10% tax on all imported goods and a 125% tax on imports from China. But the big numbers have been wiped off the board for 3 months. And on that news, the indices are up 7 to 10%. The Dow instantly jumped 1,000 points when that message dropped, and it now sits, as we record this, up 2,800 points for the day, which the Treasury Secretary said was part of the plan all along. We are still over 4,500 points down since last December. But does this give you some hope today? Is there a window here where you begin to think, maybe this scheme is going to work? Other countries are coming to the table.
I'm breathing a little easier because Trump did seem to back off. I don't know. I didn't see the announcement as such. Did he admit that he was wrong about this?
Oh, God, no. No, this isn't a capitulation.
No, he never would.
No, but I mean, seriously, he did not. He said it's a great day, and he's positioning this as it's working. It's working.
Well, we'll see if it works. As you noted in your intro, nearly all economists and also investors have been saying that this is really a bad idea, that these trade wars are going to raise prices, that you can't bring manufacturing back to the United States the way it was maybe in the 1940s or 50s, that the world economy has changed, and that this is a lot of weird, empty bluster. I don't think that there's a good chance that this is going to, quote-unquote, work, because I don't think that the nations of the world are just going to bow to Trump's wishes. But today was a good sign. It was a good sign that he backed off. We import a ton of goods from China. If we have what was the number on the Chinese tariff?
125%.
That is going to raise prices because we do buy a lot of material from China, and so it's not like he yanked them all back. That's going to raise prices. It's going to cause pain, and I'm not sure what he considers to be the actual resolution to this. Maybe he'll be able to raise some tariffs somewhere and change the way trade is balanced, but I just think he doesn't understand international economics any better than I do. I look to the experts that tell me that. I'm hoping I'm wrong about that and that he's got some evil genius going, but I doubt it.
He wants us to think it's the evil genius, right? He probably wants us to think he's pulling the Nixon, let them think I'm crazy, ploy. I don't think it's that. I think it's that he just really, really did like tariffs, but there's no way he's going to admit he was wrong. In fact, just a few hours ago, he posted on Truth Social, "Be cool. Everything's going to work out. I know what I'm doing." You know, when the president is posting, "Be cool," that's just not good. I mean, I'm really happy with the 90-day pause. A lot of experts are out there talking about we're already in a recession, we're about to be in a recession. he was beginning to freak me out a little bit. I don't mind saying.
A little bit.
So I'm happy with the 90-day pause, but it simply continues the uncertainty that the rest of the world, as well as our businesses, are now looking at the U.S. government with. You know, they don't know what to expect. Trump has already destroyed our relationships with all our allies. So it doesn't bring us back up to equivalence of before this all happened.
And a lot of people are already changing their spending habits. I've been reading about people who are just not buying things. They're not planning vacations. They're not, you know, going to build an addition to their house because they're afraid the lumber is going to cost more. And
exactly.
And that people have already sort of gotten into this mindset. And when they stop spending money, that harms businesses and businesses lay people off. I mean, there's a lot of vicious cycle stuff that goes on here. And the idea that he thinks he can stare down China. I don't know the ins and outs of our trade relationship with China. I do know that they do flood our markets with goods that are made, you know, by cheap labor and factories that don't have environmental standards that we have. And if you bring a lot of that manufacturing back to the United States, where wages are a lot higher, prices are going to go up. I understand what his problem is, that globalization has hurt American workers. It has hurt America. But I don't know that you can undo that even easily, but even in a difficult way, in a painful way, I don't think that can be undone. This idea that he said the other day, we've been abused and exploited and raped by other countries. The United States is the envy of the world. I mean, I know that our economy is not perfect, never was, but there's a reason why they have strong borders and they're worried about that. The reason people want to come here, yeah, they don't want to be in a lot of these other countries, is that we have a great country, we have a great economy, and you run the risk of just ruining that over some notion that we're getting ripped off by foreigners. And I just don't think that's the case.
I was reading a conservative economist who said, if we buy coffee from somebody in Costa Rica, but we don't sell that person anything of equivalent value, that's okay. That's, you have something that I want. We've agreed on a price. I give you the money. You give me the coffee. And now you have money to maybe invest in U.S. treasuries. And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't always have to be one winner. Both sides can win. We were rather blindly playing that game, most of us consumers, not thinking about how we're getting ripped off as a country. We were just thinking, wow, that shirt at Walmart had a good price on it, and I can't afford coffee. What is it? 90-some% of the coffee we get in this country is imported. Pete and I were looking at the numbers. What was the 80% for coffee? The fruits is 59%. The vegetables are 35%. All come from outside the country. A lot of our liquor comes from outside the country. And some of us are thinking about drinking more now. So one thing that I was wondering about is, will this 90-day pause be to our advantage or not? Markets hate uncertainty. So while we're all breathing a sigh of relief today, we may close the day up 3,000 points on the Dow, and they'll sing that as a feature, not a bug. But I'm wondering if over the next 90 days, we have 3 months of uncertainty now.
Are the markets, by rising that quickly, telling us that they don't want this trade war? They don't want these tariffs extended? That seems to me to be the message of the stock market coming back, which is like, great, you're not doing that. But it also seems clear to me that Trump is using these tariffs not as a permanent thing, but it's just as a negotiating ploy in a lot of cases. But it's not clear to me what exactly he wants in response. He was talking about Vietnam, right? And Vietnam, I guess, offered to lower its tariffs on U.S. goods to zero, which probably isn't that big a deal to Vietnam. They probably don't import all that much compared to what we import from Vietnam, which is basically, I guess, a lot of our athletic wear, athletic shoes anyway. So the question is, well, okay, so they drop it to zero, and then we drop ours on Vietnam to zero, and that's free trade, and that's what, you know, a lot of libertarians and the Tribune editorial board, everybody else wants free trade. Is that where we're headed? That's the opposite of these incredible tariffs. So it's just unclear to me what Trump has in mind here. If he's going to use these as a negotiating tool, what is the end game of these negotiations?
Well, if you get them to say, okay, we'll do zero for zero, and in some instances, that's not enough. The president wants zero tax on our stuff, but we will still tax your stuff some. Zero and zero is not good enough. But if it comes to that, that's the point of these tariffs. That's the leverage. That's it's working. How many countries have actually come to the table? The president today was talking to Japan.
Yes, allegedly like 75 countries have come to the table, and that's fine. I don't believe that we know they would have refused to come to the table without the insanity that we've gone through. You know, why would you not try that first before blowing up the economy?
It reminds me of that game of chicken, right? Where cars are driving at each other and then
this
one
is
guy
exactly
throws
that. This is exactly
the steering
that.
Wheel out the window and goes, and, okay, well, I
and don't you get the feeling that China's like, yeah, we'll crash. Let's go. Let's go. I think China is less likely to blink. Who do you bet on in that case? Who's going to blink first? China would outlast us on this sort of thing. Do you agree with me on that?
I do. I agree with you because China has a lot of the manufacturing capacity that we need. It has more of what we need than I think that
we have more to lose. Yeah,
we would have more to lose on that. They may realize that they can't capitulate. That they can't be like ABC7 and use the term Gulf of America. Because it's not going to do any good, or like Northwestern University, which got rid of all its DEI stuff, and the Trump administration is still taking $700 million.
What did Channel 7 do about the Gulf of America?
One of their weathercasters, Charlie Meyerson, had this in his newsletter. He referred to the Gulf of America in his weathercast, and I was like, don't do that. Just don't. Just say the Gulf if you have to.
This
say
area here off of Florida.
I'm digressing here, but I just, well, I do feel like that China realizes that there is no end to it if they just capitulate to Trump, that they have to negotiate, have to be as tough a negotiator as he is. He considers himself to be a great negotiator. Obviously, his book, The Art of the Deal, thinks he's a great deal maker. And that's pretty clearly now what he's going for. He's going to put this on this 90-day pause, but he's going to keep rattling his sword. And we'll find out how the markets react as the 90 days come closer, and what he really means when he's putting these tariffs on uninhabited islands and everywhere else around the world, if that really does what he thinks it's going to do. And again, all the experts seem to say no, that this is going to be a disaster.
It reminds me of his, allegedly wonderful deal making in Ukraine, right? Ukrainians need to be negotiating from a strong position with Russia. And he starts it out by saying, for sure, we know Ukraine isn't getting any of its land back. Why would you start with that negotiating position? We all know that much. And so this is very similar. Why would you start out, if you want to make any progress with China, with all this rhetoric insulting them up and down and putting them in a position where they really can't negotiate or capitulate in any way, certainly not for a while, without losing face? That ridiculous comment that Vance made the other day.
Peasant's remark?
Yes, the peasant's remark, where he was saying, he was making the point that they own a gigantic amount of our debt, of our treasury bonds. And instead of just saying the Chinese have bought it and then we buy their goods, he said the Chinese peasants.
Not a good enough history of China and U.S. history to know that that was so pejorative. What was so terrible about the use of the word peasants in that case?
No nation wants to be called as a whole peasants. I think we can assume they didn't like it because they reacted very angrily. And I think we would be unhappy if they called us like a nation of hillbillies.
I know.
Would
okay. But,
like
but,
that?
Is it,
no.
But you know, I gotta say this whole saving face, with Xi and Trump and any of these other players, Vance, whatever, isn't it amazing that we're considering their hurt feelings relative to the damage they're going to do in the name of preserving their posture or their feelings? All right, Trump. So it looks bad that you back down.
I think you're not considering that, especially China, especially Xi, is not going to consider it safe to have his power questioned in that way.
I don't know what the state of tariff negotiations has been between our countries. I, I, like I say, I don't follow international economics. I'm trying to get up to speed on all this, but you know, you talk about Vietnam, for instance, or Japan. Have there been high level tough negotiations between our countries? I mean, was it necessary to crash everyone's 401ks right. and put the country into a panic almost about this in order to get some tariff some trade concessions? If we had been to a point where we've sat down with China and China's intransigent, they're going to charge whatever they charge on us, and they're not going to stand for us charging any more than we charge for them, and it's not fair, and here's why, and we could sell that to the American public. You might get people behind that, say, okay, well, they tried to be reasonable and negotiate with them in a way that's fair to the American people, and they failed. It seems like he's just lashing out. Like he hasn't, he's mad. He's always been mad. Tariffs have been a thing for him, I guess, since the 90s. And he thinks that all of a sudden he's just going to make this grand aggressive gesture. It's kind of like he's wading into a bar with his fists flying. And I think if you could convince the public and the economists who are so critical of him, and the Democrats who are so critical of him, that he tried, that he really made a good faith effort, and that didn't work, and this is the best and last resort we have. But that's not the sense that I get or that anyone's getting.
And that's classic Trump, right? He likes to take a kernel of a decent idea, like let's cut waste out of the federal government, but then destroy the whole thing by doing it in such a terrible way.
That's a really good point, Kay. The analogy between the way they're cutting government and the way they're going at this tariff thing is just reckless. And it's not inherently a bad idea to get better trade deals with other countries. That's a good concept. It's not inherently a bad idea.
And China has been ripping us off, yeah.
I mean, have they been ripping us off, or is it just because their economy is so much different than ours? Their wage scale, their wage levels, their environmental rules are different. They've been ripping us off.
They don't have any environmental.
Well, okay, but cutting government, same thing. In controlling immigration, these things are they pull well as general concepts.
Yes,
and people are liking that Trump is taking action here and he's doing stuff about that. And I get that. And I feel like, and we've talked about that on this podcast before, that the Democrats were pretty lazy about immigration stuff. And they were insufficiently active on inflation. And some of the positions they've staked out on LGBTQ issues have been a little bit too far for the American public, or a lot too far in some cases for the public. And that, so when Trump comes in and starts saying, and government, size of government, of course, that there's government waste, and that where have the Democrats been on cutting government waste? They haven't been all that concerned about it. Well, so you've got these glimmers of good ideas, of good notions, of acceptable notions, but then you've got someone who comes in and just doesn't seem to have an incremental yet forceful approach to them.
We talked to Mick Mulvaney today, the former chief of staff when Trump was president, one of the first chiefs of staff for him the first time he was the president. And he said that in Trump's first term, they levied tariffs, and they did discuss with him what the possible consequences would be, how countries might respond. Might there be retaliatory tariffs and so forth? And it didn't spiral out of control then. At least that conversation happened. I asked him today if he thought that that was happening now as well. He's no longer in the White House. Mulvaney isn't. But he said, well, if he's not, then those people should be fired. He was specifically saying Peter Navarro should be fired, should have been fired. He's giving the president bad advice. These plans are so bad that if he's not correcting the president, he should lose his job as his chief trade advisor. If the likes of a Navarro aren't counseling him, who is? And maybe somebody was, right? But the idea that he would then, in a moment's notice, like they didn't have time to discuss, should we put on another 35% or 50%? That's just Trump. It happens so quickly, some of these things, that you've got to believe it wasn't because there was a lot of people in the room discussing it. Trump just grabbed his phone and said, here we go, 50 more percent, 125%. What have you got? I mean, that doesn't sound like, even if you disagree with the reasoning, reasoned thinking. That's just, like Eric said, walking into the bar room with your fist flying.
I assumed that it was a bad idea through and through when we were initially hearing about it in the campaign. And then he himself was pointing out, hey, if my China tariffs were so bad, then how come Biden never removed them?
Yeah.
We've still got my China tariffs in place. And I was like, oh, well, that's strange. Why is that? That after a while, they started saying, well, you know, yeah, actually, it's true that there are a lot of big tariffs against us for cars and such in the EU and for this here and for this there. And yeah, you know, actually, it would be good if we got rid of their tariffs. And I was like, oh, okay. So actually, they're admitting that there are some tariffs that we should be objecting to. It is like what you were talking about before, Eric, that it is another example of the Democrats, but also the Republicans, really, because they could have done something too, letting that slide all these years.
So who's been a bigger disappointment, the Republican members of the House or the Democrat members of the House?
Congress in general, you mean, or just the House?
No, I'm thinking of the House, but I don't care. I'll go first. Democrats. Republicans are on page. They're afraid of Donald Trump. Democrats don't have anything to lose by criticizing Donald Trump, and yet there's been no cohesive messaging. I still think of what Marge Halperin said on this podcast a month ago. It's such a good idea. Every day there should be a direct message staged in front of the somewhere and have a rotating cast of speakers and say, here's what happened today. And instead of just listing your grievances, say, and here's what we are going to do about it. Because I think that's the trap that Democrats have been falling into, too. They reinforce each other's, you know, angst about this, but there's no plan.
I agree with your disappointment with the Democrats. That's true. I am more disappointed, though, in the Republicans because, we all know Republican people were, I think, you know, everyone on this panel today leans a little left, but we all know Republicans, people who are decent people with good objectives, who
absolutely.
Just have slightly different ideas about maybe how things should be run. I certainly worked with them at the Tribune, and we've had some on this podcast. I mean, there are people who differ from us, and yet there seems to be unanimity in the Republican caucus to get behind the craziest stuff that Trump brings up, and they don't have any backbone. They don't serve any of the function of a check and balance that they're supposed to have. And so I feel like those people have lost their moral compass. They want to stay in power more than they want to do things that are for the good of the country. And that is extremely disappointing to me, because I know that there are people in that caucus who I'm sure privately would tell you, this guy, Donald Trump, is nuts. And what he's doing is terrible. But if I stand up to him, then I'm going to be primary. Elon Musk is going to throw millions of dollars at a primary chance, and I'll lose my precious seat in Congress. And that's more important to them. And I think that is infamous. And I wish that people of good character, who have ideas that differ from mine, but we both have a fidelity to the Constitution and the rule of law, would stand up and say, no, you can't deport people without just grab them off the street and send them to a prison in another country without some due process. That's just not American. That's not patriotic. That is disgusting, and I would like that. And that's why my disappointment is greater with the Republicans, because they know better. The Democrats don't know what to do. The Republicans know better and aren't doing it.
They're in more of a position to do something, Republicans.
Exactly.
Although, grant me that the fecklessness of the Democrats is at least on a scale with the is intransigence the right word?
Craven, venal, spinelessness.
I'm so cynical that although I agree with everything you said, Eric, that's just what I expect from politicians.
I don't.
It may seem very strange, but the polling, even since Liberation Day, is still showing Republicans overall strongly still favoring Trump tariffs, okay? Any Republican legislator you're saying should stand up against him on tariffs or the other things are going against a very powerful president and against their own Republican base at this point. And it's just not going to happen. I wish it would, but it doesn't surprise me that they're not going to. In order to get the tariff power back, wrench this back by revoking his declaration of an emergency under that act that they passed, I think, in 1977, allowing him to do that and take this gigantic tariff control, they would have to overcome a veto. So that's two-thirds of both houses. Not going to happen. The Democrats have just finished showing themselves to be even more spineless to stand up to their own party. President Biden, we could all see that he was losing it. The books are even now starting to come out detailing even more all the terrible anecdotes about how the party and pretty much all the elected officials knew it and collaborated to keep him in power. And not only would they not speak up, they wouldn't even speak up for having a true and open Democratic primary.
They did everything
they could to keep everybody out of it that they possibly could.
I agree with you about the spinelessness and about not everybody getting together and telling Trump it was time to go, to have one of those moments where the senators went to Nixon and told him it was time. The Republican senators went to Nixon and said it was time to go. There should have been a group of very powerful Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, and those people should have all gone over to the White House and said, look, you got to go, and this isn't going to work. By the time he finally did step down, though, I think it really was probably too late for a whole protracted primary and selection process. That could have been really, really ugly. It just, you know, I mean, it turned out badly, for sure. I'm not sure that it would have made a difference whether anyone could have beaten Trump last year. I don't know. But I share your dismay about that, and I know that these books are going to be really unflattering, and it's going down as a dark time in history. But, you know, would Josh Shapiro or Gretchen Whitmer or Gavin Newsom have beaten Donald Trump last year? I don't know, given the headwinds that the Democrats were facing. But just to circle back a little bit, I think of politicians like Adam Kinzinger, who, again, I don't agree with on a lot of subjects, but I have a ton of respect for that guy.
Sure.
Former congressman from Illinois, who was a never-Trumper, was on the January 6th commission. And where are the Adam Kinzinger? Where are the Liz Cheneys? Where are the Republicans who are willing to say, like, no, this is wrong? And I think, Kate, you were sort of implying that.
Well, there are a few, though.
Well, you see, yeah, you can say, yeah, well, Mitch McConnell seems to be now becoming one of them.
Isn't that funny?
Which is, Mitch McConnell. Along with Susan Collins and so on. But you seem to be implying that, well, because this is polling well among Republicans, and this is what their constituents want. And it may be that they're still polling well among Republicans, but they are serving not just Republicans. A Republican congressman or Republican member of Congress, Democratic member of Congress, serves all their constituents and needs to take the needs of all their constituents in mind, not just their party. If they're just thinking about reelection, yeah, okay, do what the MAGA nuts who are going to go out and vote want. But you need to look at what polling is showing overall in your district. And I know there are Republicans who are in swing districts whose constituents are scared by these tariffs, who are dismayed by the way he's cutting government, the way Trump is cutting government, who are dismayed by his extra legal ways of getting people out of the country. There are people who are very concerned about this, and they need someone to stand up for them. And these representatives are so afraid of a primary challenge that they're not doing what they know is right. And then again, that's why I'm more disappointed. I know the Democrats are in disarray and they can't find a single message and they don't even really have a spokesman now. But it's early, and I think that I hope that the midterms are a sharp rebuke to Trump and Trumpism, and that we get back into some sort of form of balanced government. I hope that the Supreme Court manages to knock back some of Trump's initiatives. It's been a little bit weird this week, where they've been kind of saying, well, yeah, you can still, what's that, the 1748 law that they're using, the Alien Sedition Act or whatever, however else they're kicking people out of the country, that they're saying, well, they're putting that on pause, but they are saying that you need due process to kick people out of the country. Amy Coney Barrett seems like she may be a voice of reason, along with John Roberts, so that conservative majority is a little fragile. And I do have some hope that the Supreme Court, they don't have to worry about getting reelected, that they're going to say, look, we swore an oath to the Constitution, and this is extra constitutional.
I'm just even more cynical, and it doesn't shock me that the only people who really care about bucking a party is the ones who are in purple districts. And I just think it goes both ways. I think the Democrats are just as bad at that. But you know what makes me a little big idea I'll throw out there? It seems like every other day now they're coming up with, I can do this under the act from, 17, blah, blah, blah. And everyone's like, what?
Yeah.
What? And that hasn't been used in 100 years and it doesn't make any sense anymore. I just wonder, maybe there should be some sort of
house cleaning
sunset law or something where
Congress
has to actually.
That's a good idea. So when you enact a law, when you enact a law that makes sense in the moment, if it's a great idea 50 years from now, we'll renew it. But everything automatically expires after 50 years. I like the feel of that. And I wonder, too. So I was at a rally in a purple district in Ottawa, and I was amazed and pleased at how many people were out, if for no other reason, because people who are scared, who are really worried and frightened about their ability to retire, about their ability to be healthy because they might lose health care coverage. I was happy for those people to have found other people who are going through the same thing. And if they were chanting, this is what democracy looks like, maybe a congressperson in that purple district, and in this case, Ottawa, it's Lauren Underwood, so she's plenty blue. She's governing or representing a purple district. But I wonder what the Republican members of Congress were thinking after those rallies across the country.
My guess, my thought, my hope is that demonstrations like that I was in on Saturday, I marched on Saturday downtown, along with 20 to 30,000 of my fellow lefties, is that this is just the start of a public mobilization campaign that will motivate and inspire lots of voters to turn out. Now, in Chicago and Illinois, does it make any difference? Does Trump care what's going on in Chicago? No, probably not.
Nope.
But that this is part of a national show of force that people will see that they're not alone in their fears and their anxieties and their disease with what Trump is doing, and that there is some sense of showing that in numbers, and that this has got to be just the start of these demonstrations, because the track record for protests is not particularly great. I think the biggest protest in Chicago history was that immigration rally, maybe it was like 10 years ago, I can't remember when it was, where like they said 250,000 people marched in Chicago. And it didn't do anything. I mean, it didn't have any effect on anything. A lot of the protests over in Israel have had no effect on Bibi Netanyahu. Did the Women's March in 2016 do anything? Was 2017, I guess, after Trump was
inaugurated. Right.
Did that do anything? I don't know that it did really, but it did give some people some courage and some strength in numbers and some feeling like they weren't alone. This has to be, if it's going to mean anything, it's going to have to be just the start of fundraising and just consciousness raising around the country, where people who do feel like they want to join a movement against Trump, or to be part of that, or to even feel comfortable feeling opposed to Trump, will feel like that they are among friends, and that their friends and neighbors feel the same way.
And that maybe has value, too. I mean, so maybe the Congress didn't vote the way you wanted to, but let's not discount entirely the fact that it made you feel like you're not alone.
Definitely good for the mental health.
Yeah.
Lot of progressives that I know, it really helped buoy them. I felt the same way about Cory Booker's speech, to tell you the truth. I kept my mouth shut when I was talking to some progressive friends. I know some people who literally cried listening to his speech, and I felt that it was kind of a silly waste of time. I was wishing I could call up one of his staff people and say, my friend Marge Halperin had a much better idea
than Cory
Booker spending 25 hours and making me wonder whether or not he could make it to the bathroom afterwards. Marge's idea is do a little bit every day.
Yeah, really. 25 days, 1 hour a day, rather than 25 hours in a day.
So I don't think they're politically going to do anything in the long run, but they are great for people to sound off and feel better and feel empowered and that sort of thing. My fear is that we're just going to see a replay of the past couple of cycles that were, if the Republicans get pushed out of the White House, I think it's going to be like, because of the same reasons as the first time, because of Trump continually shooting himself in the feet over and over and over again with the kernel of a good idea like this, that he then blows up and ruins.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think it's important to look at why working class voters, why many Latino voters and many Black voters switched over. I think that they need to right. ask themselves those kind of questions. Look at something like what's happened to manufacturing in the U.S. And when you take car plants and move them to Mexico, where the workers work for far less money, and then you bring the cars back to the U.S. and the auto plants close in the U.S. When you're a working person who used to be able to buy a house and raise a family on a good manufacturing job, and you can't anymore, and nobody really seems to care about you. Nobody seems to say, like, well, maybe there's a better way we could have done this, or maybe we could have figured out a way that you just can't have cheap labor from south of the border making these cars so that other people can have cheaper cars and we don't have a job. That empathy and that lack of strategy on the part of both parties, frankly, has got people looking for someone who posits himself as a savior. And Trump comes in and mm-hmm. seems to be standing up for those people, even though he's doing it in kind of a crazy and destructive way that's going to hurt them. They're going to have to pay more for everything. But I do think you're right, Kate, that the Democrats have to figure out a way to come back to where the voting public is. And again, they were close. I mean, I think we're talking about these drastic policy shifts, and Kamala Harris lost by about, what is it, 1.4 percentage point? I mean, it was close. This country is divided. So you don't have to, like, all of a sudden say, let's shoot the immigrants at the border or something like that. You don't have to, like, be drastic in your position, mm-hmm. or let's not give trans people any rights or anything like that. I think that you can find the sweet spots there, but they have to do an autopsy under some of their defeats. Look at what happened just last week. We talked about this in Wisconsin, and there was Laura Washington had an excellent column in the Tribune, I think it was this morning, talking about all the townships and mayoralties and all these other things in Illinois that flipped from mm-hmm. Democrat from mm-hmm. Republican to Democrat. And that tells you that voters out there are frustrated and looking for answers, and maybe the Democrats have some answers, but they're going to have to fine-tune their message. But I don't think they need to veer way off the road here. I think they can still stay on the left side of the road, but maybe not over on the
shoulder
in the shoulder there. Yeah. So
there is a decent amount of Democrats out there who are saying the problem is that we need to go farther left. That's why we lost. We must go farther.
That's why I was sorry to see Bernie Sanders. God bless him. You get 10,000 people there in Wisconsin, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're looking for a new direction, Bernie Sanders is not the person you want in front of the parade. The Rascals continue after this message from Ottawa. They're our happy sponsor. You can register for Ottawa's Midwest Morel Mushroom Fest. That's actually open right now. You can register. The event takes place May 3rd, so it's coming soon. It'll be in the memory of the great mushroom hunter named Tom Naumann. He's legendary for this sort of thing. And in his name, and he used to run this thing anyway, they have a family-friendly way to learn about and identify morel mushrooms, the gold of the forest. Folks really prize these things, but they're difficult to find. There is an area outside of Ottawa, Illinois, where they are most likely to pop up again this year, and May 3rd, they'll take you out there. So you meet in the Jordan Block on May 3rd. That's in downtown Ottawa. They put you on little shuttle buses, and they take you just outside of town. You can get your advance tickets at visitottawail.com. And I recommend you do this. It's a really pleasant walk in the woods, and you might score some mushrooms. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. And now back to the Mincing Rascals podcast. right now, Illinois seniors need to retake a driving test at 79 years old. There's a new proposal that would push the age to 87. You do not have to demonstrate your ability to drive safely until you are 87 years old, and then you would have to take it every year. Alexi Giannoulias is behind this. Several members of the state legislature, both the Senate and House, are behind it. And it looks like we're going to raise the age from a mandatory driving test from 79 to 87. I think that's crazy. I think that's a bad idea. We are an unusual state in this, in that we have it set so low, but I don't see the harm in that. Pete just handed this to me. The House voted 114-0 to approve HB 1226, which would raise the annual mandatory road test from 75 to 87. It's an initiative of Secretary of State Alexi Giannoulias, and it's off to the Senate now. Not one person voted against it. That would mean bipartisan support. I'm the only person in the state of Illinois who thinks that it's not so inconvenient or discriminatory that you can't ask somebody who is 76 years old, no, 80 years old, to demonstrate their ability behind the wheel. What is the harm in that? I don't get it.
Oh, my God. You and me need to get elected to the state legislature. That is insane.
We won't.
I will filibuster your position, however. Not that they have that in the General Assembly, but the fact is that when you look at statistics, I mean, and I think that Giannoulias, when he did this, he looked at the driving record for people of certain ages, and they find that people of that age have much better driving records than, it's like, 16-year-olds and 20-year-olds. So why not have those folks have to take driving tests every year? I think I see what he's getting at. On the other hand, you can say, well, people of a certain age like that, in their early 80s, they don't drive as much or as far or as fast.
Right.
So that would explain that. But you know, absent evidence that someone is not a good driver, I think that Illinois is one of how many states that even have an age limit at all? There are not that many that do. And I don't know that – I mean, I would like to see some evidence that states that don't have these things have many more senior citizens crashing into things than Illinois does. And I'm not sure that exists.
Obviously, it should be completely based upon people's physical and mental ability, for sure. But I just feel like it sounds like a bunch of legislators who are thinking, most of my voters skew older. They apparently want this. I better vote for it. Anybody who has ever had an aging parent knows how incredibly difficult it is to stop them from driving and potentially hurting themselves and hurting other people. I just find it an incredible, I just find it very irresponsible not to actually help people out a little bit in doing what is such an extremely hard thing.
What about the idea that you would have some sort of a method for going to the state and petitioning them to intercede with a relative and some sort of an anonymous tip line or something like that?
I believe that's in there, right?
I think it is. Because, you know, I mean, I shout out to my 93-year-old father who voluntarily just gave up driving a few years ago. Before that, we got a new car that had some sort of electronic, ignition, stuff like that. And because we knew that my mom, who was not able to drive anymore but didn't really know it, she couldn't operate the car. She just like, I don't know how to work this thing. We said, well, Mom, that's okay. We'll drive you places. And so that handled that problem. But I think that if you were to have a situation where if a parent or a close elderly relative is driving erratically, and they won't give up their keys, the freedom that a car represents, that you would have a system where you could report to the Secretary of State's
office. Well, the proposed legislation would have you also then get a doctor to sign off on that. But it would, the family could petition it, and if a doctor said that this person is not alert or aware enough, then that would be the idea. And I don't think that's such a terrible idea. And you would be able to anonymously do so because maybe grandma or grandma will figure out who ratted on them. I know what they say about the statistics, Eric, and I think you're right about the fact that since elderly drivers self-edit their driving so much, their statistics are going to seem to be safer. But were they to drive on the Dan Ryan on rush hour, they wouldn't be as competent. And so are we okay then with trusting that they'll only go to the drugstore and the grocery store and to get their hair done? They're just going to take those safe, comfortable routes in their neighborhood that they know. And therefore, we shouldn't really see if they're competent on all roads. And that's kind of what we're doing. We're saying, well, the numbers are good, but we know why they're good. It's not because they have the reflexes or the vision that younger people do. It's just that they're being more cautious. Is that good enough?
I hear you, but I want to know whether states that do have these age limits have safer driving records for seniors than states that don't. And I don't know the answer to that. Before I would sign on to anything like that, I would certainly want to see some statistical evidence that shows that. I mean, because I'm sure that's true in every state, that seniors probably drive to the grocery store, the drugstore, and to restaurants, but they're not out on the highways. They're not doing the narrow country roads at night and so on. And it might be that you'd have a system where if an elderly driver is ticketed for any reason, that they then have to go for a road test. I mean, there seem like there are some intermediate steps there, because there is a bureaucratic nightmare, just getting someone to a driving test. It's try going to the Secretary of State's office, and having that done. It's expensive and time consuming for the state and the people. So, again, I'm open minded about this, but I'm skeptical that 79 is the age.
I'm not open-minded about this. They absolutely should make it 79. The anonymous tip, the way that works, unless they've changed it up from when this was originally proposed, you can make the anonymous tip, and then the person is notified somebody has ratted on you, and now you're going to have to get a doctor's okay one way or the other. To me, that does nothing but sow distrust and suspicion and discord in a family. Grandma or grandpa is now going, if no one's going to step up and say, I did it, they're just going to feel that way about their whole family.
But you can get around that. Yeah.
But I just don't think that's a good thing. These people are retired. They can drive. They have a car and they can drive. They can absolutely have time to go and do this once a year and have a test. And if we're concerned about that being time consuming for them, then people who are 79 and older who have to have yearly tests should be able to make an appointment for a specific time and not wait like everyone else, which would be absolutely fair for senior citizens to be able to do that. And they could have made that rule easily.
And they'll tell you that that's discriminatory. I don't think that it is. We discriminate a lot of times in laws. What age can you be to drive at all? As we wrap the podcast up, and as we're recording this now on Wednesday afternoon, it's 3:30, about 8. So the markets have closed. The Dow closed up 2,962 points, up 7.87%. The NASDAQ today closes up 12% at 17,124. The S&P is up 9%. So while everybody likes to watch the Dow, it's over 40,000 again, up almost 3,000 points. The NASDAQ and the S&P did substantially better. The NASDAQ did almost twice as well. And the S&P was up a better a point and a half, almost 2 points. So that's all good. But I also worry that we're cementing in then 90 days of what the market doesn't like, which is uncertainty. Like, based on this and the negotiations that are going to take place for the next 3 months, are we going to build car plants in the United States, or are we going to find a tolerable tariff so that they can stay outside the United States? What's going to happen to Apple products now that are made in China? That's still at 125%. So I'm not sure that dragging this out is going to do us any favors in the long run, but at least today we have bought some room to breathe. Wow, those are and the president did say today, when these numbers were starting to go up, he's going, I've been told we're having one of the best days in the market ever. I'm like, yeah, it's because we're down about 6,000 points on the Dow. That's why we're having a good day.
He's an evil genius. Look what he did.
Man, oh, man, oh, man. Eric and I did get into a funny discussion on the radio this week about the show White Lotus, and the question was, how long do you have to embargo the final episode of a show? If there's a cliffhanger, or even just the latest episode in a season, and everybody's talking about it on Monday, do you have to accommodate people? Say if you're on the radio, say if you're writing about it in a Substack, do you have to warn people about it? What's the polite consideration there? And Eric, I asked my listeners about that, and only a third said that you can start talking about it right away. Everybody thereafter said you got to give it 24 hours. Some people said 72 hours. But that was one of the pieces of fallout from the final episode of this show, White Lotus.
Well, most people don't watch those shows live. I mean, they stream, so you can't. When the White Lotus episode came out the other day, right?
Sunday.
I mean, a lot of people will wait a couple of days. Even the big fans will wait a couple of days, and then there are people like me who are probably going to catch up on that series in the fall, maybe, or maybe even after that.
What are we going to do about you?
I'd rather not know who done it, but I guess you could let it slip. I'll probably forget by the time I watch it. But I would say that with a streaming TV show that's where there's a plot twist or a whodunit, I would say a year. That would be mine.
Wow.
Just to come out and say, hey, you know, I mean, and we gave this example on the radio where I said, you know, I think it's okay to say from Citizen Kane that Rosebud is the sled, and for Crying Game you can say that the woman turns out to be a dude. You know, I mean, you can say those are old things. You can say that. The Sixth Sense, if you remember that movie, I think it's okay to reveal the surprise ending of that. But those were a long time ago. I think for things that are relatively current, I think a year, that would be my view. Kate?
A year, that is extreme. We do have, obviously, a very fractured media culture now. Hardly anybody's watching the same thing. And when they are, they're now watching it at the same time, right? I think you, John, did you say you haven't watched any of Severance yet? Any
correct,
of it?
Correct. I'm like, yeah.
You've had 3 years and you still haven't watched.
I can't believe it's been 3 years. I'm like, really? I have only recently been paying attention to the chatter about this.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so that does change my opinion on it a little bit. It was obviously so different in the past, and I was not a sentient being to be aware of this at the time, but I have read that when the original TV show, The Fugitive, had its big finale where people found out, you know, who the one-armed man was in the TV show, which I don't know because I only saw the movie myself, but I just looked it up now. It's 1967, and it had a two-part finale. This is when this type of a cliffhanging finale was a really big thing still.
Yeah, sure.
And two Tuesdays in a row, it says, it aired. And it's in August. And during the finale here in Chicago, there was a giant thunderstorm. And it eliminated power in a gigantic swath of, I think, the northwest of the city and the northwest suburbs right before the show came on. People just went nuts, driving to other people's houses to find a TV where they could see the end, because if you didn't see it, that was it.
You were going to miss it.
You were not going to see it till it came around in a rerun, and you would never know when that was going to be. We all remember that.
Yeah.
And of course, in a case like that, everybody had to be ready to talk about who the one-armed man was the very next day. And I accept it's not true anymore.
Or who shot JR, if you remember that. That was in the early 80s when Dallas had that summer-long cliffhanger about who shot JR. And I actually covered that, and I can't remember who shot JR.
But you could spoil it in both those cases, because it's not like you're depriving them the chance to watch it and be surprised. They ain't going to be able to watch it. Maybe we had VCRs and you were recording Who Shot JR, but that was a fluid situation. Now you almost
a year is too long, though.
It's crazy.
I think if you said spoiler alert, I think with spoiler alert, you could talk about it right away, give people the chance to
leave the
turn
room.
Down the radio for a little bit or whatever. Or just
I agree with spoiler alert. Yeah, that's certainly fair.
But I will not ask listeners to turn down the radio. We don't do that for Olympics coverage anymore.
Oh, okay.
Really? Are you kidding me? That's like putting up a sign saying, don't come into my store.
Can't do that. Okay.
On Olympics coverage. You guys would never reveal on the air who won, like Jeopardy. You know, they keep that a secret. And the Olympics is just a TV show. Come on, I mean, nobody cares about the sports except once every 4 years. And then when they're held overnight in some foreign country and then they're not shown on TV for a couple hours, it really chaps me when like, and then radio stations are not, to me, the biggest offenders. The biggest offenders are the websites of the news outlets.
Wait, what do you want them to do?
I don't want to know who won the swimming and gymnastics and the javelin and the hockey and all that other stuff.
Did they knock on your door? Did they come to your house and tell you?
They do, because I go to these websites. I go to the Tribune.com, NewYorkTimes.com, places like that, and I want to see what's going on in the world. I don't want to see spoilers on these sporting events.
I'm not working for NBC Sports, man. If you want to watch it, go turn on the TV tonight. But I have this information. Some people won't see it this evening. And you're asking me to, for the benefit of that TV network, which isn't my business, you're asking me to sit on that information. I have no interest in helping
them. But it's not really news, though. It is. It's just,
you don't think, if the U.S. men's Olympic basketball team lost a game, or if one of our female gymnasts fell, you don't think that's news?
I don't think it's news. No, I don't, because if one of our female gymnasts fell at any other time, it wouldn't be news. I mean, it feels to me like you're taking an event like a game show. If you found out who won Survivor or who won, America's Got Talent, you found out somehow and you told people, they'd be furious at you, because that's just as newsworthy. Who wins Survivor is just as newsworthy as who wins, rhythmic gymnastics.
Oh, huh. And by the way, don't throw rhythmic gymnastics under the bus. Go ahead and do it with U.S. women's gymnastics. Really?
And I know this is an unpopular opinion I have, but I wish all media would remain silent until the events air on television.
Kate, what was the thing that you wanted to bark about today?
Extinct animals. There is no...
Speaking of media coverage...
No dire wolf walking around. You want to give me a minute on that?
I'll give you 45 seconds. Wait. Go.
It's odd because the main media is pretending like this is true. It is not true. There are no dire wolves. There will be no dire wolves or woolly mammoths. All they're doing is taking, in this case, a gray wolf, and they're adjusting only 20 genes. They're only editing 20 genes to make it look like a dire wolf. That's all they're doing.
Oh.
And so all it is a tricked out wolf. And you know what? Dogs are descended from gray wolves. It's really just a tricked out dog.
I thought they defrosted some amber and found ancient wolf DNA from 10,000 years ago and then recreated the extinct wolves. That didn't happen.
No, they have, and it is an amazing thing that they can sequence the genome of a dire wolf and a man.
To recreate them.
And that's what makes them say, oh, look, this is something we could do to make it a little bit more like a dire wolf. But even if they could adjust every single gene to make it exactly like a dire wolf, it still would not be the same.
Sometimes it's a shame to let the truth get in the way of a good story, because the story's been told somewhat differently, but now we are correct.
Oh, yes, it has. But the biologists, the real biologists, are really out of their minds about this. they just can't believe it.
That's Kate Plies. You heard Eric Zorn, too. I'm John Williams, and that's this week's edition of the Mincing Rascals podcast. We are produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. Okay, Kate, well done.
Thanks.
Thank you very much,
fun.
Eric.
Yep.
Guys, lots of fun. We managed to power through there, huh?
Yeah, that was good. That was fun.
We'll see where we are in the world next week. All right, you guys.
Yeah, oh my God, thanks. Yeah,
cross your fingers. See you later.
See you guys. Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.